from KXJZ in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up in the program, local Olympic gold medalist Gabe Gardner. Also, the local music professor who's won a prestigious award for young American artists. And Sacramento's fastest chihuahua on her way to the National Chihuahua Racing Championship in San Diego. First, the Democratic National Convention wraps up today with Barack Obama's acceptance speech. The convention has moved from Denver's basketball arena to the city's much larger and outdoor football stadium. Sacramento photojournalist Max Whitaker has been in Denver all week covering the convention. A few minutes ago, I spoke with him. He was in the rafters above Invesco Field where he was stationed with his camera. And I asked him how the scene at Invesco compares with the Pepsi Center.
Well, Invesco Field is much, much, much larger than the Pepsi Center. The Pepsi Center is, much similar to Arco Arena. It's a basketball arena, big, but still has a somewhat intimate feel to it. Invesco Field is a huge modern football stadium, 76,000 seats, and then I believe an additional 3,000 more seats on the field for the actual delegates.
This evening, Barack Obama is going to give his speech at the end of the evening, accepting the Democratic Party's nomination, but the events are starting early in the afternoon, 3 o'clock Denver time. What's happening earlier in the day?
We're starting off with some smaller musical acts and working into Sheryl Crow, Stevie Wonder, Jennifer Hudson, and Shawn Johnson, the Olympic gymnast, is going to be giving the Pledge of Allegiance.
My goodness. Now, describe to us where you are and why you're exactly there.
I am in the highest point at Invesco Field. It's literally the highest point that you can be at and not climb a ladder. And my job here is to get this sort of big picture view of the scene, sort of a wide view that shows the whole stadium and the Denver skyline in the background. Barack Obama himself will be very small and not even visible, but it'll give, hopefully, readers at home an idea of what it was like to be here.
I'm talking with Sacramento photojournalist Max Whitaker, who has been in Denver all this week covering the Democratic National Convention. I've heard that a photographer with ESPN is next to you. Is that right? And if so, why is ESPN at the Democratic Convention?
Well, actually, I believe they're working for CNN, but it's a company called Skycam, and they are providing very unique camera shots, live camera shots of the event here. Basically, I'm sure, listeners have seen NFL shots where they have the camera that kind of swoops over the field. They're using the same camera here to give, rather dramatic shots.
Now, earlier this week, one of your assignments was covering protests. How big were the protests that you saw, and did anything particularly noteworthy happen that you managed to capture with the camera?
The protests were relatively mild by convention standards. I think the largest ones I covered, this is gross estimation on my part, were probably 3,000 to 5,000 people. And the most noteworthy one was last night. A protest was led by Iraq war veterans, and they marched in full dress uniform to the Pepsi Center and presented a list of demands. I'm not sure what those demands were, but a representative of theirs was able to go inside and speak with Barack Obama, and they left satisfied. So there was no arrest, no violence of any kind so far that I've witnessed.
You've also covered at least one event involving Hillary Clinton. What was the event, and what happened there?
I've covered several events with Senator Clinton, starting with her arrival here Denver, and then the last one I covered was yesterday when she formally released her delegates to Barack Obama. She somewhat hedged her bets there by telling her delegates that she released them to release her delegate votes to Barack Obama, but told them to vote with their hearts. So I believe I wasn't at the actual roll call last night at the Pepsi Center, but I believe everything went off smoothly and all the delegates did go for Obama.
What was the best shot you've managed to get so far since you got to Denver?
That's tough to say. It's probably a toss-up between the first photos I got of Senator Clinton where, she was under a lot of pressure from many sides, regarding how she was going to handle her delegates and the roll call. Made some nice frames there. And then, you know, there's some really emotional photos last night with Iraq veterans. They really felt strongly about their cause. And as a photographer, it's great because it happened right at sunset with good light.
Have you seen much disruption to the people, the regular people of Denver because of the convention? I understand there's been some closure of interstate freeways because of the events at Invesco. And just in general, have you seen much of the people of Denver around Invesco and the Pepsi Center, or does it seem like it's mainly people involved with or around the convention?
Well, first I want to say, Jeffrey, that Denver has a very similar feel to Sacramento. It's kind of like a bigger version of Sacramento. Everyone's very relaxed. People are extraordinarily friendly. Every time I've been in the light rail, people come up to me, talk to me, you know, told me about their city. It's a beautiful city. There haven't been any road closures yet, but they are about to close I-25 in advance of this event here. Many of the major roads in downtown Denver have been closed all week. And I know most Denver residents that don't need to go downtown this week have just stayed home.
Yeah.
I think the biggest impact besides the road closures has been the tremendous police force out on the streets. Apparently Denver and also the federal government have taken security very seriously. And for the past week in Denver, you can't walk more than 5 minutes without seeing a squad of police officers in riot gear, fairly heavily armed too. So it's a little ominous feeling at times, but everything's gone smoothly.
And next week you go to St. Paul for the Republican convention, right?
I do.
What are you going to be doing there? Same sort of thing?
You know, the same sort of thing. I mean, we sort of plan every day as it comes, but my assignment's going to be roughly the same. You know, a lot of outside protests and features, and we'll see. It'll be interesting to compare and contrast, you know, especially I'll be interested to see the difference in the protests, because obviously the Republicans are currently the administration in charge, so I'd imagine the protests will be a little bit more antagonistic.
I see. Well, Max, I know that the day's events are just about to start at Invesco Field, so I appreciate you taking a few minutes to talk with us.
My pleasure, Jeffrey. Great talking to you.
Sacramento photojournalist Max Whitaker at Invesco Field in Denver. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, we'll talk with a local music professor who's won a prestigious award for young American artists. We'll be right back. You're listening to Inside from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. I got started in radio as an intern. Many people in public radio did. Apply to be an Insight intern. You'll find out how on the careers page at capradio.org. Struggling to select the right college? On the next Insight, that's Tuesday, you'll meet a UC Davis management professor who's written an algorithm to help prospective college students find the right fit. Also, Sierra-based author Todd Borg has a new mystery out, Tahoe Avalanche. We'll talk with him about the latest adventures of Detective Owen McKenna, plus some of the jockeys in this year's Virginia City Camel Races. Finding the time to work on ambitious projects can be a challenge for emerging artists. A prestigious award called the Rome Prize aims to help. It's an 11-month-long fellowship offered by the American Academy in Rome, Italy. One of this year's winners is a music professor at UC Davis. Kurt Rohde was awarded a Rome Prize for musical composition. He joins us on the phone. Kurt Rohde, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much.
Well, what do you plan to do during your 11-month fellowship in Rome?
Well, while I'm there, in addition to trying to learn the language, which I've already started and find to be a lot easier than German, I'm going to try to write an opera and also write a violin concerto, which are two sort of standard types of genres for concert music.
Wow, that sounds like an ambitious workload.
Yeah. I doubt that I'll actually be able to complete both, but I should be able to make a fair amount of headway.
How concerned is the American Academy that you get done what you told them you wanted to do? Or did they even ask you what you wanted to do?
Yeah, they actually, they wanted to know, you know, why would I want to go there in particular? Why would anyone want to go to Rome to work? And what would the project that I would be working on have to do with actually being in that location? So, you know, you have to sort of, if you make it to this, you know, the selection process is pretty rigorous, and when you get to the final round, they actually want to speak to you about your project and about what in particular the connection would be. And for me, going to Rome is part of this long desire of mine to write an opera. You know, Italian opera is pretty, you know, pretty much a standard part of the repertoire, and it's got an incredible tradition. But also, puppet operas are really big in Italy. And so I've been really interested in writing a puppet opera, and I thought that this would be the perfect opportunity to take full advantage of that by going there, researching what puppet operas are like in the different regions in Italy, and, you know, try to incorporate some of those aspects into my piece.
Do you mean an opera where the characters are played by puppets?
Yep, that's exactly what I mean.
And what appeals to you about that?
I just sort of like the idea that it's, you know, puppets have this, because puppets are, you know, they have this really sort of fixed expression a lot of the time on their face, but they're in the mechanical movement of a puppet. If you've ever seen a really incredible puppet master, I mean, they almost, there's this strange, almost disembodied type of quality, because they can become incredibly lifelike and really emote in a way that is disarming. And I think that having this object, you know, this thing that we look at a puppet and we think, oh, well, that's just, you know, just a piece of wood with strings. It can't possibly, you know, touch us. But to see this object that's actually being manipulated to actually emote something really, you know, the full range of emotions, is that disarming quality actually makes you, at least it makes me, sort of just feel the emotions in a much more unexpected way than if it was actually having a person up there who you sort of know what the drill is when you have a real, you know, live singer up there doing what's sort of expected.
My guest is Kurt Rohde, who is a composer and a violist. He's also a music professor at UC Davis, and he's won a prestigious award for emerging artists. He won a 2008 Rome Prize for Musical Composition. It provides an 11-month fellowship at the American Academy in Rome. We have some of your clips of some of your music lined up, and we're going to listen to them and talk with you a bit about it. And one of them is a very familiar title, but not in the classical music genre. It's Maxwell's Silver Hammer. This, of course, is your reworking of the Beatles song, right?
It is, from Abbey Road, yeah. There was a project that the New Century Chamber Orchestra, which is a San Francisco-based string orchestra, did several years ago when their music director, Krista Bennion-Feeney, decided that she wanted to get a whole bunch of different composers to arrange different songs from the Beatles' Abbey Road album, and I was given the option to do my own arrangement of Maxwell Silverhammer and Sun King, which is the other song that I arranged.
Yes. Well, let's listen to some of Kurt Rohde's adaptation of Maxwell Silverhammer. When I listen carefully, I can hear strains of the original melody of Maxwell's Silver Hammer, but it's obviously quite different and in many ways. How did you approach reworking Maxwell's Silver Hammer for your style of music?
Well, I mean, the fact that you can actually recognize the tune is that's great. I mean, that's what I hope, you know, people, when they listen to it, they actually can hear the actual tune underneath everything that's going on around them. And there's a lot of activity, as you well know. And it's the actual affect of my version is very, you know, for those of you who know the actual song, the Beatles song, it's almost a complete opposite type of affect. So
yes,
The Beatles song is, you know, it's this very dark humor about, you know, Maxwell who's going around killing people by hitting them on the head. But it's all sort of done this very droll, sort of stately, almost monochromatic way. And I just thought that, you know, it would be sort of cool to have almost like the underside of what it would, of what's going on inside of, what I sort of imagine is going inside of Maxwell's head, which is, you know, sort of, he's sort of seething underneath. To be doing out of the blue, just going around doing what he's doing, because it seems a little odd that someone would just, you know, knock on someone's door and then just hit them on the head with a hammer. And,
indeed.
So that's, you know, that it was basically not that much more complicated than that. It was, you know, composing, I find, is you know, you don't have to have the most incredibly original idea about what you want to do in the piece, but it's the imagination of what is sort of a relatively simple idea that can, you know, that's what's exciting about composing. You can be sort of how far you can imagine a relatively simple idea into something that, you know, would otherwise be banal, I guess, or sort of just ordinary.
Did you start off by improvising with the original melody in a straightforward way and then elaborate on it and enhance it, or did you start off with something that was already quite divorced from the original Beatles version?
No, I started out with actually what I originally did was I took the whole song and I just wrote it out with the chords. So it was just the song and the original, much more, you know, slower, sort of stately tempo, and I just had the chords underneath it. And then I sort of in this particular piece, what I did was I sort of sliced it up, because you can tell the rhythm is sort of jagged and there's a lot of, there's just a lot of stuff shooting around the melody. Even the melody is not, you know, it's not connected. It's sort of, it's disjunct, right? And so I would just sort of slice things up. It was, it'd almost be akin to someone who would be splicing in a recording studio. And so by slicing it up in, you know, different ways, you get this sort of choppy, energized rhythm. And also, I increased the actual speed of the song. I think it must be at least four times as fast as the original.
Yeah. It's officially a Lennon and McCartney song, but I think Paul McCartney actually wrote it.
He
has actually written or participated in the writing of some classical music or music that's inspired in the style of classical music. Do you know if he happens to have heard your take on Maxwell's Silverhammer?
I think he actually heard the entire set of arrangements of Abbey Road when we did the when New Century Chamber Orchestra actually did this concert with the set of arrangements. I think he did, and I actually never heard back. That's not like Paul McCartney did not call me up and say, you know, what have you done to my song? You know,
yes.
No, I have no. I do know that he did hear it. Or, you know, at least something, you know, the recording was gotten to him, but I'd have no idea what his feedback was.
Kurt Rohde is an assistant professor of composition and theory in the UC Davis Department of Music, and he's one of the winners of the 2008-2009 Rome Prize for Musical Composition. It's a prestigious award for emerging artists, and it provides an 11-month fellowship at the American Academy in Rome. Let's listen to an excerpt of another piece of music written by you, and this is the first piece from the six character pieces for viola and piano. Let's listen to a bit of it first, and we'll talk about it.
Okay.
You're a violist. Is that you playing the viola there?
In that particular recording, no, it is not. Actually, that recording is the person for whom the piece was written for, a really incredible violist named Nokuthula Negyuanama. And she commissioned me to write that piece for her debut at the Kennedy Center.
Do you ever or often play in public pieces that you've written?
I do often play in the premieres of or subsequent performances of my own works. It's a little overwhelming because it's enough to be able to prepare, you know, a Beethoven string quartet for performance. And then it's also sort of intense enough to have a piece of yours being played in performance. But to put them together becomes sort of a little bit of an overload for me. I enjoy it, but I have to get my head in the special place to sort of gear up for that. It's not something I prefer to do all the time. But
yeah,
I
can understand. I'm wondering what your role though is in such a situation, because you are in a sense the expert because you wrote this piece of music. But in that context, you're just one of several musicians. How do the other musicians typically relate to you as the composer of the piece, but also as one of their colleague musicians?
Yeah, well, it does change depending on, you know, if I'm playing or not. If I'm not playing, then in general or almost exclusively, people just sort of look toward you and defer to you for pretty much input and feedback and comments. But when I'm actually playing, also part of what happens when I play is that I don't make an effort or I don't make it a point to be composer first and then performer second. I'm there to play my part in my piece. And I sort of I interact in a way that's much more as if I were to interact if I were playing, you know, the Beethoven string quartet. So I think that, you know, people sort of pick up on this pretty quickly, so that it becomes much more of an interaction among all the players, or if there's a conductor with the conductor, so that people don't necessarily always look to me. And often I find that I'm not asked the questions nearly as often when I'm playing as if I were just sitting, you know, listening. That's usually what happens. And I really prefer for people just to interpret the piece themselves without too much input from me, because I find that really interesting.
Is it easier or harder to write for your own instrument?
I haven't thought about that. I mean, writing for strings is really not that, it's not something I think about as much. You know, if I'm writing for percussion, that I have to really think much more. I have to think more about what I'm doing. Whereas with strings, it comes quite naturally. And I think for writing for viola, I'm sure it doesn't even, there's no blip on the radar screen in my brain when I'm writing for viola. I just do it.
My guest is UC Davis music professor Kurt Rohde, who is one of the winners of this year's Rome Prize for Musical Composition. Here's another piece of music that you wrote. And again, it's quite different from the others that we've already heard. This is the first piece from the Five Pieces for Orchestra. Kurt, the sound of that music, it has a more lush sound than some of the other pieces we've heard by you. It almost reminds me of music for film.
Yeah, I mean, actually, that's a very common comment that I get from my orchestra music, actually. A lot of people sort of imagine that this is music that could easily be a soundtrack, which I'm sort of happy that people would feel that way. Because,
why?
Because I think it shows, you know, I mean, I find film music to be really fascinating, because film music can really either enhance or sort of destroy what's going on up on the screen in a way that you don't really realize as the viewer. I think there was a moment in the movie The Hours with the Philip Glass score where the Julianne Moore character is in her bed before the water sort of rises and covers her, metaphorically in the movie. And the music that leads up to that moment is just incredible. And I think that, you know, if you can, you know, that also shows that there's some type of some type of story going on inside of the viewer's head. And I sort of think that's great if a listener in a concert without any, you know, movie going on can sort of also make up a story. I sort of imagine that they're making up a story in their head as well, if they feel that, you know, it has sort of the same qualities as a film score, which, you know, that's great.
Did you have a story or visuals in mind when you were writing that music?
No, not at all. No, not for that piece. I mean, for other pieces, yes, but not for that piece. That piece is actually an orchestrated version of the piece you played before it. The piece you played before it, the viola piano piece, the character pieces, it was an interesting project for me because I got this commission to write this orchestra piece, but I didn't have, like, I write very slowly, and I didn't have, like, you know, a year to write an orchestra piece. I had, like, 3 months. So I thought, well, this is an opportunity to do something I've never done. And I took that viola and piano piece, and I orchestrated it. And so it really doesn't sound like the viola piano piece at all. Like you mentioned, it's, you know, much more lush, and it has sort of a richer and more warm sort of rounded edges sound.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's exciting to me because it means that, you know, I was able to, you know, at least meet that challenge.
You also write vocal music. Let's listen to Love's Lens. I know that you've written for the San Francisco choral group Volte. Is this Volte singing here?
That is, in fact, Volte. Yes.
Yes.
That's actually, I think, one of the live performances of the piece.
Why do you write for voice?
Well, I actually don't get much of an opportunity to write for voice. That was one of the first. I think that's actually the first own a cappella piece for chorus that I wrote. I've only written for voice only sort of nominally before that. And in this particular case, it was really very exciting because I really had to, you know, just having a chorus that has no other instrumental, there's nothing else but just the human voice in groups to work with. That was a really exciting piece for me to work on because I really thought of the voice as a new instrument group rather than just the voice.
Do you sing?
Not in public.
Did you have to familiarize yourself with what it takes to be a singer in order to write for the human voice?
I would write only what I could sing. Of course, you know, I mean, that sounds, in theory, that sounds lovely because, you know, oh, well, great, he only writes what he can sing. But, you know, at the same time, it's not like I'm singing, you know, for anyone. I can sing it in, you know, in the privacy of my own home and not want, you know, no one else is going to hear that. So, but, you know, I do have to take into consideration that, you know, the people who are going to be singing, well, it might be easy for me to sing it. The people who are going to be singing it are actually going to be singing it with other people, and they're going to be singing it in front of people. So, you know, that actually does play a consideration into how you write for voice. So, you know, it was interesting to do it.
Yeah, you know exactly what a viola can do and related instruments, but you might not know what a human voice can do. Did
Correct.
You have to make revisions to this once actual singers sang it?
Not in this piece. There were absolutely no changes, which is unusual for a piece of mine. Usually there are changes after the first performance. But this piece was, nothing had to be changed. It all worked out.
Okay.
I was really lucky.
We have one more piece of yours lined up here. It has an unusual title. It's the Stretto from Oculus. We'll listen to a bit of that, and then we'll find out what that means.
Okay.
Okay, Kurt, help us understand the title, The Stretto from Oculus.
Okay, well, Oculus is, this particular piece is an 8-movement piece for string orchestra, and an Oculus is the opening at the top of, it's the single opening at the top of a large building, so that when you look up into the Oculus, you can see the sky, so you're looking upwards towards the heavens, and then, you know, there's the theory that the heavens are looking down to the earth through this opening. And this particular movement is called stretto, which in Italian means it means narrow or sharp. And the whole idea in music, when you have something that's stretto, the tempo of the piece all of a sudden increases. And there's a type of excitement because that happens instantly because all of a sudden everything has just been pumped up a tremendous amount. And in this particular movement, if you listen to the music, it's actually just one. There's only one melody going on to the entire thing, but it's being handed off to all the different string instruments in the orchestra. So that's why it sort of sounds. You get this rhythmic feeling, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, because it's being handed off through all the different instruments. And that gives us sort of this feeling of getting tighter and getting more exciting and sort of pushing forward.
Mm. When you go to a classical music concert by most orchestras, if there's any new or relatively new classical music, it's usually a short piece, and it's usually the first piece that's played on the program by the orchestra. It's almost like they're trying to get it out of the way at the beginning of the program. Do you feel that way about the way many orchestras program newer classical music?
Well, it's interesting because I tend to not go to traditional concerts. So the concerts that I go to tend to have a lot of new music. So it's not just the first piece. It'll be the second piece, the middle piece, and the last piece. And I think that, you know, it is for the few traditional types of orchestra concerts I go to where that is the case, where there is the first piece on the program. It doesn't necessarily bother me that it's, you know, it's first on the program. I guess it would bother me more if it turns out to be a really exceptional piece, and then it is sort of gotten out of the way, and there's sort of a, you know, everything afterwards sort of becomes this disappointing letdown. Because that actually does happen. Every once in a while, you really get this smashing new piece at the beginning of the program, and, you know, then you get to the stuff that everyone's heard far too often, and that's just the way it is. I think there are a lot of conventions that we just don't really think about why they're conventions. I'm sure there are other really good reasons why people program the new piece at the beginning, but mm-hmm. I haven't really thought about why or if that, you know, how I feel about that.
I know that there are many people who listen to classical music who like those older, more traditional works, and for them, listening to a lot of newer classical music is difficult sometimes for them because they feel like it doesn't have the melodies or the distinctive rhythms or even just the pleasing ambience that you so often find in all kinds of music, including classical music. And you often don't get those qualities in newer classical music. How do you respond to that?
I think it's a valid concern. I mean, I think that certainly there is something that really is distinct about new music that separates it from music that was written 100 years ago. But, you know, I don't think that necessarily means that there isn't music that has those qualities that you just mentioned that isn't being written, because there certainly is plenty of new music that's being written with those qualities. You know, I think that what happens is that, you know, the packaging just becomes different, and you just have to sort of look at the package a little bit differently. And it's the same thing as with, you know, for people who were listening to Richard Strauss in the 1890s or 1900s, you know, I mean, I'm sure that if somebody from 1800 was listening to something like Salome, their hair would have fallen out. They probably would have said the same thing about. I know for a fact they did say the same thing. You know, those things, a lot of that stuff changes with the times, and a lot of it also has, there's a more than just a grain of truth. There's a lot of truth to the fact that there's a lot of music that's actually quite difficult to listen to. And, you know, different people have different thresholds for what they're able to absorb. And, you know, that's just the way it is.
And finally, Kurt, when do you leave for Rome?
In 3 weeks.
And you'll be gone for most of those 11 months, I guess?
I will be. Yes, indeed.
And how do you maintain the everyday necessities of life back in California?
I don't know. It's going to be very interesting. It's a big move because I have to, you know, take a fair amount of stuff and sort of put everything in order here and just trust that it's going to be fine. Most things are going to be fine. Most things are not I mean, I have, everything is sort of set up in a way that it can be put on hold for that amount of time. But, you know, I think it's going to be super.
I can imagine so.
Yeah.
Well, Kurt Rohde is an assistant professor of composition and theory at the UC Davis Department of Music. He's won the prestigious Rome Prize for Musical Composition, provides an 11-month fellowship at the American Academy in Rome. Kurt, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, Sacramento's fastest Chihuahua on her way to the National Chihuahua Racing Championship in San Diego. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. If you missed a previous Insight, it's okay. Check out our archives at capradio.org/insight. Coming up this afternoon from KXJZ News, how the state budget impasse, nearly 2 months long, is affecting the everyday lives of Californians. That story is later today on All Things Considered. We had planned to bring you Olympian Gabe Gardner on today's program. That's not working out. We hope to reschedule him sometime soon. Sacramento's fastest Chihuahua is about to compete in the National Chihuahua Racing Championship in San Diego. Her name is Isabel, or Izzy to her friends. She joins us along with her pal Clarabelle, also a Zippy Chihuahua, and their owners, Travis and Crystal Kropelka. Travis, Crystal, Izzy, Clara, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Now, we need to clarify something first. Although Izzy is officially Sacramento's fastest Chihuahua, she doesn't live in Sacramento. Where do you and Izzy live, Travis?
We're over in Boulder Creek. We have a lot of family in this area, so we came here to do the race.
And Boulder Creek is just north of Santa Cruz?
Yes, in the mountains.
Yes, very nice. So you came over here with Izzy to compete in the Sacramento races. Were there no races in the Bay Area?
Actually, there is a race, the San Francisco regional race, which actually Clara won last year. But because we have so much family and a new baby, we thought visiting the family and having them come to the races and a built-in babysitter was a good idea this year.
Great. And if you heard ears flapping and a collar shaking, that was Izzy, I believe.
Yes.
Yes. Now, Travis, you have Izzy in your lap. Since Izzy can't speak for herself, can you describe her, please?
Sure. She's the queen of our household. She expects everything to be done for her. She's 6.5 years old. She was a present that Crystal gave me when I started law school, actually. And she's gotten used to being waited on hand and foot. That allowed her over the years to get pretty fat. She had ballooned up to almost twice her ideal weight. She was over 11 pounds. She's supposed to be 6 pounds.
Wow, so she was twice her ideal weight.
Just about. And we tried any number of things that we could think of, the diet, dog foods, and so on. Finally took her to the veterinarian, and they diagnosed her with a thyroid problem, got her on medication, and she's now down to just under 8 pounds on her way back to being sleek and trim.
And she's a sort of chocolate brown color and very cute.
Thank you. Chocolate and tan, yes.
Chocolate and tan. Very nice. Crystal, you have Clarabelle in with you. Could you describe Clarabelle for us?
Well, Clarabelle is kind of our shy dog. She's all black and has kind of a pig's tail. She's got a curly tail. Clara is our long leg dog. She's the speedster of the family. Izzy is actually our slower one, but she's very determined, which is why she won the Sacramento race.
Izzy won this year's Sacramento race. Clarabelle was competed too, didn't she?
Clara did compete this year. She had won San Francisco last year. And this year we had all expectations for Clarabelle, and she got into her semifinal race and decided that she would rather play with the dog in the lane next to her rather than run to the finish line.
Oh, dear. Still, you have some success in your canine family. Travis, what's the secret? How do you train such speedy chihuahuas?
You know, there's no special or specific training, and I'm not sure how it is we ended up with two, and there are only two dogs. that could win races and get us the trip to San Diego. We walk them regularly, daily, on a regular walk. We take trips down to the beach at Santa Cruz, to the dog beaches, whenever we have a chance, and let them run on the beach and so on. So they live, perhaps, and I'm just speculating here, perhaps a more active lifestyle than a lot of Chihuahuas do, but there's no particular method that we use to try to get them to run faster than any other Chihuahua might run.
We're talking with Travis and Crystal Kropalka. They live in Boulder Creek. Their Chihuahua, Izzy, earlier this year won the Sacramento Regional Chihuahua races, and Izzy is going to be competing in San Diego this weekend on Sunday for the title of America's Fastest Chihuahua. Now, on our webpage, capradio.org/insight, we have some photographs. Our main photograph is an adorable picture of Izzy sitting on a rug looking up. But at the bottom of the page, you'll find three action photographs, as if they were from ESPN or something. Now, just talk us through these photographs. The first photograph, the one at the bottom left, Izzy doesn't seem to be doing so well.
No, and that's the key race. To win any one of the regional races from the 15 cities, the dogs have to place in the first two, in their first heat, to advance to the semifinals, then win the semifinal of 10 dogs, and then win the final race of anywhere from 4 to 6 dogs, depending where you were. So there were 130-odd total Chihuahuas that raced in Sacramento. Izzy slid into second place in her first race. But what you're looking at there, however, is her semifinal race that she did win. And even though she's 3 feet behind or 2 feet behind there on that 35-foot track, that was the pivotal moment. That dog that's in the lead is a dog named Tiffany Diamond, who won from Sacramento last year and was the defending champion.
Well, let's look at the second photograph. As you can see, Izzy is getting close.
Yes, she's closing the gap. I had released her, and so I was seeing that from the back, and it was a little difficult to tell. It all happens in a matter of 2 or 3 seconds. They race the track, but yeah, she's closing the gap, and then I think probably your last photo is the crucial one.
Yes, indeed. Crystal, did you feel good about Izzy at this point?
You know, it happened so quickly, and you're just urging her on. I'm, you know, at the finish line, and I'm just screaming for her to come. And she was very determined. We had realized she really focuses on me at the finish line, and I have her favorite treats in a recognizable Tupperware for her, so she knows that when she gets to me at the finish line, she gets turkey hot dogs.
So you were standing at the end of her lane.
Right.
Calling for her.
And yes.
Travis, where were you?
I was behind the starting gate, having released her through the starting gate.
So you were launching her, Crystal, you were tempting her. So we're about halfway through the race here. The third and final photograph we have. Wow, look at this. It looks like Izzy wins by a nose.
Definitely. They're neck and neck, about 3 feet from the finish line, and a classic sports lesson to be learned here.
yes.
Tiffany Diamond, the defending champion, in the lead, turns to look when the competition pulls neck and neck with her.
Fatal
mistake.
That was what I think the French swimmer who was going up against Michael Phelps did wrong in the Olympics. I think he turned around and looked at Phelps, and he lost by a hundredth of a second.
Must have been.
So this is great. Crystal, is Clara in this race?
Not in this race. They actually had separated Tiffany Diamond and Clarabelle so they would not race in the same semifinals, since they were previous champions from 2007. So they wanted them to race in separate semifinals so that possibly we could have both of them in the finals. But Clara messed up her chance by deciding to play and not run in her semifinal race.
Well, I asked if Clara was in this one because you'd mentioned that Clara did that, and there's at least one dog in this picture here that is straying out of its lane. Is this a common problem with the dogs forgetting what they're supposed to be doing?
It's a riot. It's really funny. That's what Petco likes most about the Chihuahua races, is that the majority of the Chihuahuas don't run straight to the finish line. They stop to sniff each other. They stop to play. They have accidents in the middle of the track. There's all kinds
poopy
of things.
Accidents.
Yes, all kinds of things that happen. And it's just a fun day out in the sun with a bunch of Chihuahua owners.
Yes. Travis, do you think that Izzy has any idea what's going on?
She knows what she's out there to do, which is to get over to where Crystal is with the turkey hot dogs as quickly as possible. I doubt that she has any particular notion of the competition. I haven't sensed in her any recognition or awareness of the other dogs and her need to beat them.
Crystal, rather, what are the stakes here? What does Izzy win? What do you and Travis win if Izzy is fortunate enough to be named America's fastest chihuahua this weekend?
You know, in San Diego, the prize is a $300 gift card to Petco and a really nice big trophy that actually Izzy would fit inside of. It's a big trophy. But really, the prize we enjoy is the trip to San Diego. She's already won the best prize for us, is the trip to San Diego, because Petco actually pays for us to fly to San Diego with the dog and pays for our three nights in the Omni Hotel there right next to Petco Park.
Yeah, certainly many thanks go out to Petco for doing it, because they're bringing people in from across the country.
Wow. Well, it sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. Tell us what chihuahuas are like as pets.
I think that there's a misperception about chihuahuas, that they're trembling, quaky little dogs that yap.
To be fair to chihuahuas in general, Izzy and Clara have not yapped and they haven't trembled.
Yeah, they're very placid and they're good dogs. And at the end of the day, they're dogs. I mean, they want to chase the cat. They want to lay in front of the fire in the wintertime. And, you know, even though they're only 6 or 7 pounds, ultimately their behaviors are those of dogs.
You said they like to chase the cat. I know that you have a cat, Annabelle. Does Annabelle get chased around by these two zippy chihuahuas?
Isabel actually learned her lesson very early on in her life. Annabelle is a couple years older than Izzy, and so was established in the household when Isabel came along. And Izzy got a cat claw to the eyeball, and so she does not bother Annabelle at all. Clara, on the other hand, will not leave Annabelle alone. And we often find Clarabelle with cat feathers or fur out of her mouth, as we know she has bitten the cat in the haunches.
Oh, my goodness. Finally, there's a movie coming out, a Disney film in a couple of months, Beverly Hills Chihuahua. I know that dog owners have mixed feelings about these kinds of things, because people who shouldn't have a certain kind of breed suddenly think, oh, what a cute dog. I'm going to get that dog. What do you think? Are you looking forward to the film or do you dread it?
I share that concern that you mentioned, honestly, and it's something that I've thought about even before the film, because you see chihuahuas in the arms and hands and purses of the celebutantes, you know, that are popular in the media. And I think the movie, while it's certainly a kick for kids, and I'm not going to, you know, suggest at all that it can't be perfectly enjoyable, I do get concerned that chihuahuas just get bought up by too many people owning too many chihuahuas because of their popularity. And then ultimately, when the joy wears off or the initial excitement wears off, then who knows what happens to that dog.
So I would hope that the people who see the movie and are enjoying that, I know Petco is big on this, is they always say think adoption first. So if you see the movie and you want a chihuahua, adopt an older one, and then you can give one that's already around a good home.
Yes. Well, thank you both very much, Travis and Crystal Krapalka, owners of chihuahuas Izzy and Clara. Izzy won the Sacramento Chihuahua race earlier this year and will be competing in San Diego on Sunday for the title of America's Fastest Chihuahua. Thank you all so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeff, very much for having us.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. If you missed a previous Insight, it's okay. Check out our archives at capradio.org/insight. Insight's theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver and Ellie Fox. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The assistant producer is Robin Souza. The senior producer is Jen Picard. Insight's executive producer is Carl Watanabe. And thank you for joining us.